This 11 o'clock session has been titled How to Deal with Opposition. Perhaps we could even expand that to how to handle conflict. And perhaps you would understand the difference there when I define some terms that would help us in dealing with the subject. There are two or three texts that have I have used personally in arranging our subject today that I would refer to you. I learned that one of them is out of print now. It's a little book by Leslie Flynn called Great Church Fights. I don't know if you've ever had opportunity to see that little text, but the title tells you a little something here, doesn't it? Talk a little about it, but one that's been very helpful in this for this type of study is a book by Robert Bramson titled Coping with Difficult People. Now, I'm quite certain that anything that I say today and any references today would not be to anyone present. It certainly will be somewhere else. But dealing with people is an extremely important responsibility for a successful pastor. The preacher who said he wouldn't mind pastoring if it were not for the people was someone who was having problems. I believe he's probably out of profession. But in Dr. Bramson's book, Coping with Difficult People, he takes the time to set forth some types of people. Has a group he calls the hostile aggressive. Three categories under that title. One is the Sherman tank. Those who can just mow you down, roll right over you, go right on. Then the snipers. Those who, in a kind of indirect and hidden way, like to lodge somewhere up on the tree limb and take a good shot at you with snide remarks or innuendos or even humor. Then there are the exploders. These are those who, often without signal or notice, just blow up. It's sort of like some of the things going on in the world today. They like to blow up at a time when they can do the most damage and hit the most people. These terrorists are doing that today in cities, and they look for the place where the most are gathered when they do it. Then he talks about the complainers. We always have those with us, and I don't know that that needs a lot of explanation. He has a category called the clams, these unresponsive and silent people who, though they will not say much, you can tell that something's going wrong because, like the toad, they just begin to swell, and while not talking, certainly indicating something is going wrong. He has the super agreeables. These are those who talk a lot of support. They can stand right behind you, it appears. They're always publicly and openly indicating what a great person you are. But when it comes down to the vote, when it comes to the action of putting it on the line, you just can never seem to get them around to be agreeable and supportive. He talks about the wet blankets. These are the negativists, that we've never done it that way, and it can't work. It won't work. He talks about a category of bulldozers and balloons. And these are the know-it-all experts. The bulldozers are those who know it all. They know that they know it all. They know that you know they know it all. And they like to use that knowledge to pursue and promote their own ends. The balloon, on the other hand, is the phony know-it-all, the one who likes to make you think they know it all, when in truth, they're just a bunch of hot air. Then he talks about the indecisive stallers. These are those who, for whatever reason, they can't or won't act. They can't come to a decision. Well, it's an interesting book that I think you'd find very, very helpful. I have used an outline from Myron Rush's book on management, A Biblical Approach, a very fine book. Dr. Rush is the president of a Christian management organization out of Colorado, a very, very intelligent speaker and author. The little book I referred to on great church fights, Dr. Flynn attempts to talk about the problems in the local church in the first century. The fact that in the early church, and it seems to stagger some people that such great men as Paul and Barnabas would have a conflict, that there would be some problem that would cause differences, and King James says a contention which became so sharp that it actually caused them to separate their ministries and go in different directions. And a lot of people, because we hear more about Paul, less about Barnabas, are of the opinion that Paul was right and Barnabas was wrong. I don't think we can really base that on that fact alone, for you see, the author, the historian Luke, was with Paul. It seems very appropriate that he would be writing much about Paul's ministry, and it was the pleasure of the Holy Ghost to see that we receive that ministry, not necessarily that Barnabas was wrong. Matter of fact, the time came when Barnabas' assistance and help with John Mark, who was the third party who brought the contention, actually brought restoration to where even Paul wanted to have Mark with him in the ministry. There is an interesting difference that arose in the church in Philippi between two women, and when Paul wrote the letter, he included the very fact that he includes a comment to Euodias and Syntyche says that their conflict reached the point where it was affecting the church as a whole, or I don't think it would have been significant enough for him to bring it up. But he says to these two ladies, it's time for you to quit fussing and to have peace with one another and get to your act together. And I'm sure it was an interesting experience for the pastor of that church to read the epistle and include that to those two ladies. Good public admonishment must have been interesting. John tells us about Diotrephes in his third epistle, a brother who brought such conflict in the local church, trying to become a church boss, if you please, to determine who would be allowed to come into the church, who would be allowed to speak in the church, trying to shield the church from the apostles, trying to deny it from its tie with the fellowship. And we have people who do that today. And to read about Diotrephes makes me think of a poem that Brother Savell used to refer to dwell above with saints we love, that will be grace and glory. To live below with saints we know, that's another story. I mentioned to you the defining of terms. When we talk about disagreement, we must not confuse that with the word conflict, because differences of opinion are common among people, especially when we have different backgrounds, different training. And there's nothing wrong with disagreeing. Brother Adams likes to talk about our learning to disagree without being disagreeable, which is a very important clue to good leadership. But when disagreement takes an advanced stage, it becomes opposition. That's where you position opinions in a posture against each other, whether it's public or private, for the purpose of one becoming the accepted opinion. When opposition, and opposition in itself doesn't have to be bad, but it's certainly an advanced stage over just disagreement. But when opposition reaches the level to where there is in it hostility, open anger, when attitude goes beyond just wanting to find a solution to something, but now wanting to be opposing for the sake of control or having your own way, and you're willing to allow the spirit of anger to get into it and open hostility, then you have what I'm defining as conflict. And I would add one other definition in the session this morning, and that's the word confrontation. When I talk about this, I don't mean getting into an argument or disputing with one another, but just the matter of confronting, coming to face to face, such as Paul says about Peter in Galatians 2. He said, when Peter came to Antioch, I opposed him face to face because, according to Paul, he was in the wrong. And what I'm talking about when I mean confrontation is just the coming face to face to deal with the issue and to determine how to resolve whatever the disagreement, which has become possibly strong opposition or even worse, has become conflict. Now, to understand or to feel that there's anything of real consequence to a session like this, it's going to be important for us to understand the potential danger that lies in conflict, the danger to destroy, the danger to actually tear down something that's good. I dare say that sitting here this morning are men who have had in the past friendships with individuals that do not exist today because they were destroyed by unresolved conflict. And that's tragedy, isn't it? It's also a tragedy with a church or an organization. For you see, no one's immune from conflict. And unresolved conflict can lead to the destruction of friendships and of disturbing the families and the breaking up of the local church as well as an organization itself. That's why Paul warns the church at Galatia. The NIV says, my brothers, you were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh, the sinful nature. Rather, receive one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command: love your neighbor as yourself. It's interesting that that command can be found in Leviticus. But then he adds to this, if you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. Now that's a powerful piece of information for us in dealing with this matter of conflict. And I want to say to you this morning, brethren, that I don't want you to look upon this session as one in which the superintendent is just dealing with the ministers, but as one who pastors or deals with people at whatever level in your ministry. We must understand how, as leaders, we can resolve conflict, we can deal with it, understand it, understand what it can do to the church, but understand the method, the methodology, our approach to the best solution. That's what's so important for us today. We know the source of conflict. James 4 says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your selfish desires that battle within you? So we know the source of conflict. We know that it's not coming out of the fruit of the Spirit, it's coming out of the works of the flesh. We know that it comes out of strong, selfish desire. Anytime that we our objective is to impose ideas or beliefs or desires or opinions on others, you can expect conflict. Also, there's in conflict a strong emphasis always on self. There's an involvement of pride. Proverbs 13:10 says, pride only breeds quarrels, but wisdom is found in those who will take advice. Now, there are some negative results that every pastor must be aware of in dealing with conflict. You see, conflict is a spirit. It becomes a very strong, dominating, controlling spirit in a person. And it will cause us, first of all, it will cause us to magnify and to fabricate faults and weaknesses in other people. And this is a tragedy, but it's true. When you see people who get so caught up in it, they'll go to any extent to justify their position and to win the dispute. And once we're convinced that we're right and someone else is wrong, you can count on it, we'll go to any length to prove our case. I mean, to the point of not just discrediting another's view, but the tragedy is that we will go to the extent of discrediting that person. And it seems like one of the most impossible things that you can do in dealing with conflict among the people of the church, people in the work of God. It seems impossible to limit negative feelings just to issues and to keep it away from persons and personality. It seems like it's impossible to do that. But this is a terrible negative factor that we have to deal with, and that is the magnifying, looking. Once we start, our aim in goal is we've got to win this dispute. We start marshaling all kinds of forces together and trying to find what couples will do this in a marriage. They'll start hitting below the belt. They'll do anything to win the argument and start bringing up things, and you think you're dealing with one issue and here comes something that you thought it was buried, and 10 years ago you dealt with it, and here it comes up again. How did that get into this argument? But you see, once conflict, when you get to the point of real hostility, we start playing dirty pool, as someone said. I don't know how to play dirty pool, but I suspect it's underhanded. Someone said it's when you start knocking the ball. What is dirty poo? What did you tell me? Someone told me about what it was. But anyway, we play it that way. A second negative result is that conflict creates divisions within the church. We must be aware that unresolved conflict is the cause of the majority of our church splits. And we shouldn't allow that to surprise us. Matthew 12, our Lord has taught us every kingdom divided against itself will be ruined, and every city or household divided against itself will not stand. We understand that there is, within the rage of conflict, there is a desire to build your case and to get every person and everything on your side that you possibly can. Consequently, that's why, and maybe it was in the case with the Philippians, these two women, they would not keep their disagreement just exclusively between the two of them. They wanted to seek others to get in. And that's what people will do. And to the point that they'll go around, and people who don't know a thing about it, they'll try to solicit them to get on their bandwagon. And it just keeps on until a church can be totally polarized by the argument that really belongs to two people, and yet they've sowed it and spread it to where they've gotten groups in, and people are like sheep, and they'll run and jump into something when they don't know beans about it, and they'll get on that side, and they'll rattle the can just because, oh, that's a friend, or that's some, yeah, they're bound to be right, you know. It's a very difficult thing that can happen here. It can polarize a church to where it can split a church right down the middle. I can tell you of a case of one of our great congregations divided right down the middle between the people, and the pastor was the source of that conflict. I sat on a platform and watched a very large congregation, and one half of that congregation, when the pastor would say something, they would just almost like they were at a football game and he just made a touchdown. They'd shout and hoop, and the other side was stone cold. I mean stone silent. You could not get a word out of them. They were so filled with hostility and anger over what they perceived to be wrongdoing. Now, brother, we must preserve the church from this kind of spirit. We're called as leaders to do that. We're called to do our best to keep the peace. A third negative result of conflict is that it causes us to expend our energies on non-productive activities. And it becomes extremely detrimental to fellowship productivity. A deacon came to one of the presbyters in our district a short time ago and he said, "Would you come and help our church?" He said, "We're having such conflict. We're having so many meetings being called. And there's such confusion," that he said, "I can't even go to my job and do an adequate job working." He said, "I can't concentrate. I can't think." And he said, I am actually allowing this thing to so affect me that it's affecting my productivity on my job." And that's the case. Families, friends, church members can become so drained that all of the spiritual energy that we should have toward doing the work of God, it has been consumed by the angry, hostile spirit that has just eaten us alive. And you know something's wrong when a person can just be so angry that they're just eaten alive. All of their mentality is eaten up. They cannot think. They have no objectivity to them. It's nothing but just being possessed with getting my way. You can see how evil it is just by the way it destroys what it eats up within us. And our people become physically and emotionally drained. And I've seen good ministers who've been caught up and embroiled in something like this. And to see our wives, companions, and the children just drained to where they don't even have any life, any sensitivity, any joy. Everything's been drained out. That's a result of conflict. No wonder the Apostle Paul has said, if it is possible, in Romans 12, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Live in harmony with one another. He makes those two statements to this church at Rome in the same chapter. And we are called upon to know this kind of negative result and do everything possible to resolve it. There are some positive aspects of disagreement, differing opinions. Now, I didn't say positive aspects to conflict, because as I have defined conflict as involving hostility and anger, there is nothing good in that. Now, we have some people and preachers. You know, we've had some of our brethren. You can't have a good district council unless you've got a knockdown drag out. Bless God, we need a fight. Now, God is not 100, He's not 100 miles close to that kind of attitude. He's nowhere around it. There's nothing scriptural about it, nothing biblical, nothing spiritual. And some of our people think that in the local church. When it comes time for the annual business meeting, it's not worth a dime if there's not been a good fight. And so there's nothing. Airing carnality in a business meeting is futile. There's nothing to be gained by that. But there are some positive aspects to just disagreement, having difference of opinion, because it can lead to individual growth and church development. Let me explain what I mean. Proverbs 27:17 says, "As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Now, there is something that can be said for differences of opinions and differing viewpoints to be brought together and let them sharpen one another. Some of us have been so fearful of someone who differs with us that you'll find some pastors, preachers will say, "Well, all right, I don't agree with that, and so I'll just go paddle my canoe. I don't have to fool around with with the fellowship of the district or the section. I can just go do my thing. That's an abuse of sovereignty. But more than that, you are denying the process by which you can develop and grow. Because there's nothing that can help us like the sharpening of other viewpoints. And having, in meetings like this or in other gatherings, to have something brought up, it may differ with us completely. Not only, I'm not just talking about biblical understanding. Some of us we need some sharpening there, the way we think today on some scriptures. I think we could easily be sharpened up. But I'm talking about even the way we do things. We can actually develop and individually grow and prosper by hearing differences of opinions that come. We're too often like the porcupines who, in their effort to try to keep cold during the winter, they would get together, but every time they got together, they needled one another. And that's the way we do too often. We're always needling one another. It's hard to get something out of being with someone and you're needling them all the time. Some of them think we're called, they just hear the first part of that verse about let us provoke one another. But the Bible said to provoke to love. But we just hear the first part, and we dearly do love to provoke somebody. But we can actually, through as an iron sharpens iron, so that our being together can sharpen us. That's why we need one another so desperately. And that's why you stay by yourself and you get to the place where you can't accept anything from anyone. You can't have a new idea come to you. You have to be the manufacturing agency for every new idea in your church or out of your life, and you're headed for trouble. You have no one to guide. You have no one to help you, keep you in bounds. That's why we get brethren who can get out on limbs and they get sawed off and they don't know what on earth happened. Because here they were just running their, you know, running that little canoe on. No one would they be willing to receive instruction from or hear what they have to say. And that's why fellowship is so important, brethren. That's why it's so very important. Disagreements can reveal the need for change. They not only develop us and help us in our growth, but they can reveal the need for change. A mature leader will welcome a different viewpoint because it forces us to evaluate the way we're doing things. Proverbs 18:15, the Living Bible paraphrases, the intelligent man is always open to new ideas. In fact, he looks for them. But an immature leader will be defensive about it. He'll become resentful when people approach him with an idea of, hey, let's do this differently. And there are some ways that we can improve, brethren. New ideas, disagreement over the way we do something can become a healthy way of helping us to see how we could change for good. There are some of our churches who are still doing things the way they did when the church was founded back in 1920 and 30. Someone has never had a new idea. And so it continues. I've gone into churches and the way I was treated as a visitor. I was in a church not too long ago, but I was really impressed with the people didn't even know who I was. And when I sat down in the Sunday school class, what really impressed me was these people were doing this without trying to butter up the superintendent. People would come over and introduce themselves. I had no idea who I was, but just so friendly. Well, I've been in church and Sunday school classes where it was so cold and frigid that they would look at you with a glance, and you could tell that what that was in their mind. What are you doing here? I've had a Sunday school teacher to walk over when it was the time for the new literature to be passed out, be handing out literature, walk up and say, "You don't get one of these. You're a stranger." Now, isn't that a wonderful way to say something to a visiting? Was that lady surprised when the stranger turned out to be the pulpit guest that day? There are some changes that can be made to help us. The tragedy is if you're a person who is resentful toward a new idea, usually disagreements, because our people being saved and coming into the church, they want to see God bless. They want to see the church develop. They want to see God do something. And if they come to an idea and you say, well, thank you, but go sit down. I'll provide all the ideas around here. You can count on it. Disagreement will arrive rather quickly. And usually that attitude will allow it to blossom into a conflict. And we're called to utilize disagreements and utilize differing viewpoints and let them help us to develop our work. And thirdly, disagreements can help make us more tolerant of opposing views. Disagreement is an excellent teacher, tolerance for us. Here is a way of being able to accept without being hostile. We can react without some kind of a negative attitude towards someone, because we understand, as Proverbs 23 says, don't refuse to accept criticism. Get all the help you can. And brethren, we're not above criticism. Please do not fall into the trap of the infallible preacher. There are none. And don't reach the place that you cannot be taught something. There's no place in the scriptures for an arrogant man of God. No place. We can all learn something. When people approach you and show you or have something to say, I was preaching a few years ago in Oak Cliff, in Dallas, little lady come up after the early service, and she said, I have a word from the Lord for you. Would you receive it? And I said, yes. She said, well, I'd like to say it to you privately. I said, well, there's another service here very shortly. Let's just step over here. She said, well, the Lord has told me to tell you that you are overweight. Will you receive that? And I said, yes. Well, actually, I didn't think it would take revelation for that. I thought good eyesight was about all she needed. But when we started home, Joyce said, I believe that lady had something for you. But to be willing to accept any kind of admonishing, any kind of criticism, will be very valuable to us, because some of it's going to be unjustified, but there's going to be a great amount of it that has justification to it. And we are the wiser if we'll be those who will receive that criticism and to utilize it to our good. There are several methods which people use today to deal with conflict, and most of them do not work. Let me tell you about some that don't work. There is an attempt to avoid conflict by retreating from it, and that's an approach that altogether too many ministers use, to attempt to deal with it by just avoiding it, retreating from it. This becomes futile because, well, actually there are many ways to retreat, to run away from a problem. But the most common in our fellowship is procrastination, just delaying to deal with it. Just kind of putting off with the proverbial ostrich. We stick our head in the sand and think, it's going to go away. And when we pull our head out of the sand, it's not only there, but it's there bigger than ever. And we think, well, some way if I just won't handle it. Now, no one likes to deal with conflict and opposition, especially when you're dealing with people who have reached the point of being very hostile and aggressive in their spirit. But I want to tell you something. The longer you delay dealing with conflict, the worse it will become. In conflict, as I've defined it here today, brethren, I can think of no, and I know of no, times when delay or time will ever be your friend. Time will always be your enemy when you're dealing with conflict and you try to deal with it by procrastinating, putting it off. Frustration grows, anger grows, and there will be no solution, only the problem increasing. There's another method that I see used quite often, and that's to attempt to handle conflict by sidetracking to handle a minor issue or circumventing it by dealing with just side and minor problems, never getting to the real one. And to avoid real issues and just to spend time on some minor issue, something that that you can deal with and not actually deal directly with the real problem, can not only add to the difficulty itself, because there may be a sensing of dishonesty in it. You see, often a person who is unwilling to deal with the real issue and going to side issues is usually attempting to divert attention away from the main problem and the real conflict. And if people know that we are siding the thing, moving around, circumventing it, and we're not facing up to it, then our credibility is raised and comes into question. Now, there's only one way and one real workable method to deal with conflict, and it is that it must be faced head on. Just like Paul said regarding Peter, I opposed him face to face. It did not mean that he was ready to be angry or ready to fight, but it meant that he wanted to deal with it the only way you can deal with it, and that is to face it head on and to identify the real issues. Gentlemen, there's no other way. And the third step is to work until a resolution satisfactorily can be found. And that doesn't, sometime it won't be resolved in 30 minutes. And sometime it won't be resolved in just an hour. It may take longer. But there is no way you can deal with conflict outside of facing it, identifying the real problem. And these are days when, even in counseling, in the earlier session we were talking about counseling, there are many, many times when you talk with people and their real problem is not the one they bring to you. It's always underneath. But sometimes they'll bring another problem up on the table just to see how you're going to deal with that before they determine whether or not they're going to really come on with what's really eating them. But this is certainly true with dealing with conflict. You must get to the heart of things. And sometimes we don't want to get to the heart of it because we know that it may involve us personally or involve our ministry or a rejection of our ministry. But when you're dealing with your people, not just necessarily something between you and some member, but in dealing with your people, if there's going to be any resolution to problems, those people must face that issue. And you can't just keep letting the thing build and think that Sister So-and-so and her family can sit over here and other Sister So-and-so and her family can sit over here, and as long as they don't meet, it'll be all right. Don't kid yourself. That's just throwing your time bombs out in the audience. That's ridiculous. You know, some people think that they misunderstand even New Testament conflict. Do you think Paul and Barnabas were men because that they had a contention over John Mark, that meant when they came to a council meeting that they never spoke to each other? If you think that, then you're reading carnality into it. That's not an apostolic way. Those men were greater men than that. But the must for resolving a conflict include the fact that there's got to be honesty. Our people must be honest with one another. And that's a growing problem among our churches. Sometimes it's a problem in ministry. These are days when preachers have been guilty of standing and holding a lie in their right hand, and as Isaiah said, couldn't even identify it. It gets bad when you can't even, you are so subjective that you can't objectively step back and look at yourself and say, I'm wrong, or I am guilty, or I have lied. What kind of a specter of professionalism is it that we would pull? What kind of a cloak will we pull over ourselves that would make us to stand before someone and say, I am innocent when we know we are not? Well, I have told the truth when we know we have lied. And our people have got to be honest. We've got to restore honesty among our people. And to restore that spirit by which they will be willing to forgive and to ask forgiveness when attitudes of anger and hostility develop. You see, today we have allowed to develop in our fellowship this in our churches. If a conflict arises and it's between the pastor and the board or pastor and some of the church, for many of our people, the only resolution they know of is the pastor should leave. It's the only solution they know of. How we have allowed such unscriptural teaching to develop among our people. And brethren, we have to point our finger at the ministry. We are responsible for this. We're guilty for this. And maybe some of it's because of what we've done with among the ministers. When conflict arises, some of our ministers, the only thing they know to tell someone is, if you don't agree with me, there's the door. The only solution they know. Now, sometimes that may be the case, but oftentimes you are doing a terrible thing to sheep, forcing them out of your fold when they have been unruly, they've been unscriptural, and you force them out rather than take the time to discipline them scripturally. One of the greatest weaknesses in the Assemblies of God today is our position and our application of scriptural discipline. It takes time, it takes work, it takes effort, and many pastors don't have the heart or the spirit or the scriptural understanding to handle it. Consequently, all we know is run them off, get on off down there, and too often our fellow pastor down here, he's just so anxious to get hold of them until he'll take them in and say, it was just a personality conflict. Bless your heart, it was sin that was not disciplined and handled properly. And consequently, the same disease that sheep had in this sheepfold is going to, instead of being quarantined, is going to spread in your sheepfold. And God is calling us to resolve. We've got to be honest. We've got to be willing. We've got to be willing to forgive and to ask forgiveness, especially if we've had the audacity to stand in the house of God and stand up with anger and every work of the flesh. We've been willing to exhibit that carnality before God and His people. It's time somebody called us to repentance and to ask forgiveness for such an unscriptural and ungodly way of acting in the house of God. Our general superintendent gave one of the most impassioned pleas to us during the general presbytery about our churches not losing the sense of the sacred. Nothing is greater in the need today because brethren, often we have lost the sense of the sacred. We go through our routines. We have everything down. We know how a preacher ought to act. And it's all routine. It's ceremony. We're the biggest ritualists in the world. We blame the high church and the Roman Catholics when the truth of it is sometimes all we are is ritualists. It's just a Pentecostal ritual. And underneath there is no genuine sense of the sacred, and sense of love for God and for the fellowship. It's just a crusty, hardened, we're so full of bitterness and things that we couldn't be forgiven because we can't even see we have any need of being forgiven. It's everybody else. He walked around his room, this place stinks. Walked into the kitchen, he said, "Hun, what's wrong around here?" And she said, what do you mean, husband? He said, "This kitchen, it stinks." And he walked outside. He sniffed around. He said, "The whole world stinks." And isn't that the way we are? What's the Limburger cheese? We've got to also, brethren, be willing to trust others to make decisions in the best interests of all concerned. You know, there are times when decisions overrule us, when our church board does not feel we have a good decision, sometime in building, in new programs. Sometimes the congregation will vote in opposition to us. We can take an attitude. I'm the leader here. You're out of the will of God. I'm the only one who knows what the will of God is around here. We're going to do what I say. Now, when you take that position, weigh it out carefully, because there is such a thing as winning the battle and losing the war. So you be sure you know what you're ready to take stands on. Be sure there. You know, the fact of it is, most of us, we get so embroiled, so caught up in stuff that we can't really be subjective. And consequently, you give us a little time to back off from something and look at it. And sometimes we won't even want to do what we're proposing. And I've also seen, even my own pastoral experience, I know you have too, I've seen when I wanted something and the board didn't or the people didn't, that if I would be submissive in my spirit, the time would come. I've had time come when the board made an absolute reversal and got completely in agreement with me over something that at one time they weren't at all. And in my submissiveness of spirit, my willingness to want to work for the best, and sometimes there are decisions that we've got to be willing to trust others when they have a strong majority feeling about it, that their decision is for the best interest, because often we think that there's no way they could understand what we ought to be doing here. They don't understand what God's doing here, and we don't trust them. Lastly, we're going to have to be willing not to judge the motives of others. Nothing hurts worse than to have your motives judged by people that you know that they don't know what's in your heart. You know that you were not guilty of what they are claiming that you have been motivated by. And nothing hurts worse, at least to me. But there's a biblical approach to handling confrontation. And I'd like to just deal with this with you quickly, because you're aware of it, but I'm referring to Matthew 18. Let me ask first of all, brethren, when we go to dealing or helping our people deal with conflicts, Let me urge you, the first thing, don't play with guesses and hearsays. Be certain that you are dealing with facts. How many times we've gotten people together and to find out that the issues between them, they didn't even understand themselves. The rumors that were circulating, the
things that had been said and action, reaction, and all built up, and it was not even, they didn't even understand. We must deal with facts. Keep our people, we ourselves, deal with facts. But secondly, just to run through the method which our Lord has given to us in handling the confronting, dealing with people. Remember, number one is that it must be done in private. And it's wrong if, well, Jesus said, if your brother offends you, go and, I like the Phillips translation, says, go and have it out with him at once. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, knock down, drag out. What he's just saying is that just between the two of you, go and don't let it, don't procrastinate it. Go and do it right now and see that it's done. If you go anywhere else and talk with someone else before you deal with the person that's involved in that, you're wrong. And I've seen pastors who have a problem with a member of the church, and they'll get with the board and they'll say, Sister so-and-so is doing such and such, and trying to build board support. That's wrong if you haven't dealt with that person. But it's also a problem in the church itself. If people will not deal one-to-one, it must be private. Jesus expects that most of our disagreements be resolved in private. That's biblical. And to have a deacon or a board member to come into a board meeting and say, Brother Pastor, so-and-so is really out of sorts with you. You've been doing this and the other. My first question to a board member like that is, Brother, what I want to know is, what did you mean by handling something like this and being the bearer of it to me? A board does not represent the body to the pastor. Have you directed this lady to come talk to me? If not, why not? Have you arranged to bring her to me? Why are you acting unscriptural? But more importantly is that we understand the necessity of the private encounter, taking the initiative privately. If that fails, Jesus taught us what to do. Take some so that there be witnesses. And this may well be where the board can come in, and some of the board going with you are meeting with people at an advanced stage of the thing. And if that does not work, then to go to the church with it. And let me tell you, it's after verse 17 that Jesus says, and whatsoever is bound in heaven shall be bound on earth. Whatsoever is loosed in heaven shall be loosed on earth. Do you know what he's actually saying? That in the church, there is the authority of heaven when we rule upon conflict. And we're talking about the judgment of heaven to support the action of a body to deal with someone who has not been willing to submit themselves to the brotherhood. I'm telling you, this is a very serious matter. It's not to be taken lightly. There are some personal applications that I want to, Myron Rush suggests that I think it'd be well if we would carefully weigh it out. One is that we evaluate our church and ourselves. If you have a staff, it might be well that the entire staff get together and just look over not just the positions and policies, but the relationships. Look over the people who are in leadership in your church, the Sunday school, all the departments, and look over it to determine where areas of potential conflict might lie. What's being done? What's your Sunday school superintendent or your district CE director doing that's agitating your teachers? There's a way that we can actually work here to prevent conflict. And sometimes we pastors, you know, it's hard to believe that we would be responsible for agitation and creating things, but I was sitting in the office here some time ago. Brother Dubose, Brother Adams was with me, and my secretary walked in, and she looked rather distressed, and one of them asked her what was wrong, and she said, "Oh, I have a headache, and it's this big, and it has bridges written all over it." And I couldn't believe she would have the audacity to say something like that in the presence of those brethren who I knew would be happy to go out and tell it. But don't kid yourself, Pastor. You may be the one creating the headache. Let's evaluate, because the second thing he suggests is that we begin developing solutions and taking corrective actions now. Don't wait for the conflict to materialize. Let's be alert to what kind of pressure we're putting on a secretary or a staff or our people. There may be a way to resolve some things we're expecting, or ways that we do things, our mannerisms. It's amazing how we can, I know some of you preachers don't believe you can improve, but get a tape of yourself sometime. It'll amaze you. You'll say, "You mean my people have had to listen to this? What wonderful people they are. How patient." Thirdly, if you are currently involved in a conflict, whether it's a personal one or in your church, take these principles of Matthew 18 and begin to work them now. If you have families that are in conflict, begin bringing them to work these principles of Matthew 18 now. Don't let it keep on. It's not going to go away. And lastly, we must make sure that our actions demonstrate a spirit of love, and that we are not anger for anger, hostility for hostility. That'll do nothing. But the Proverbs did say that a gentle answer, soft answer, will turn away wrath. But brethren, we are called to be peacemakers. We are called to help our people to resolve their conflicts. And there comes times when we get personally embroiled in it, and that's unfortunate, but it happens. The enemy would like to discredit your ministry. But there's still a way that we personally can deal with it. But remember, we are called to keep the peace and to bring our people to grow and not allow the terrible devastation that conflict can bring to a church. We don't want any more of our churches destroyed. In this very district, we have churches that do not exist today because of unresolved conflict. We don't want that to happen. We want God to bless our fellowship and to bless us and to make our people to be people who are spiritual people, walking with God, serving God, loving one another, loving the pastor, and believing that this is our time to do His will. Let's thank Him that He's called us to the kingdom for such a time as this, shall we? Father, we thank You. We praise You that You have made us Thy servants. You've called us to proclaim Your gospel and to pastor the church of Jesus Christ. Lead us in the ways of God that we'll not fail. We'll serve You and be everything You've called us to be, to the glory of the living God.